I'd like to give a talk today called Holding It All Together. Sometimes on retreat, we come into contact with the river of experience that's going on, and sometimes the river is in flood. There's so much more going on in our own experience than we could experience. There's so much more color and sound, sensation and thought, emotion, mood, energy, dynamic. Sometimes it feels like a rich abundance, and sometimes it feels like too much. And we may hope from meditation to learn how to hold it all together. And until now, we've been kind of pretending to hold it all together, assuming that others have it together and others obviously don't have it together. We're usually somewhere on a spectrum comparing to others. We feel triumphant when we feel we've got it all together, which is just something that sometimes happens. It sometimes happens that we feel cheerful, we feel acceptance of the body and the mind, we feel friendliness in the world, and we feel there's enough. That sometimes happens. And that is also a kind of state that we could cultivate without having to hold anything together. So we could cultivate, we could play with enoughness and friendliness and acceptance, a deep acceptance. So sometimes when I hear myself say the word acceptance, I can feel us all in the room thinking of a sort of half acceptance or a kind of tolerance without actual real acceptance. The deep acceptance that we also know is possible. We've had moments where we had no demand on ourselves or the world, and it felt smooth and peaceful and silky and kind of sustainable, possible. We could live there. That happens to be one of what are called the four pillars of, or the four gatekeepers of liberation in one of my favorite Sanskrit books. You could also call it contentment. So just to stretch our meanings for the word acceptance, to let it be possible that it's not just trying to accept or tolerating what we don't like, but actually noticing that that's how life is. Even if we don't want it to be that way, even if that doesn't match what we thought it was supposed to be. That a deeper acceptance is possible in a human being, including in yourself. And that when that happens, it feels good, instead of feeling like a defeat. I think for now we have this half acceptance because it seems to be defeat. So when the mind is crazy, there would be a wish for it to be different. But there could be this whisper of a deep acceptance that the mind is going crazy right now, like a feeding frenzy or something that we can sometimes experience, witness in nature. Sometimes, for various reasons, there's a cloud of insects going crazy, or a cloud of sharks going crazy. And there are reasons that that happens, even if it surprises us. So if there's a cloud of thoughts going crazy, that's deeply natural. So even if we could still experience that sometimes the cloud of thought is unpleasant, uncomfortable, when we allow the possibility that it's deeply natural that that happens sometimes, instead of that it's my fault, we can unlink the experience that is unpleasant. So a cloud of thought is often unpleasant. If we can unlink that unpleasantness from a sense of shame or ownership about it, and let it be deeply natural and unpleasant. The sensing of it as unpleasant is important. That's a kind of sensitivity and knowing that we have, that we want to recover and clear from the judgmental, blaming, shaming action. So we could let it be deeply natural and much less unpleasant than it was when we thought it was our fault and something wrong, and slightly unpleasant. And slightly interesting, just like that cloud of insects or cloud of sharks or whatever. And that leads into a second of four so-called gatekeepers of liberation, which would be curiosity, the willingness to let not necessarily questions in verbal form in the mind form. That might happen. There might be a question of words like, why are these insects together? Why are these thoughts going crazy tonight or whatever? Or it might just be a kind of different energy inside that is open, that's open to be in contact with our experience, even if it's a little unpleasant, because we're not making it go from unpleasant and even painful to suffering. So the difference between pain and suffering. Pain, unpleasant things happen every single day. That's natural. And our habit of weighting that with shame, blame, fault, covering up, pretending, etc. Our habit of weighting that down is, we could call suffering, unnecessary suffering. So there could be an uplifting energy of, wow, this is deeply natural. There could be some interest into why it's happening, but also some interest in what happens just in contact with what's happening. Not necessarily needing to analyze why it's happening. So a sense of wonder even with what's unpleasant. And that leaves a wide open space for wonder with what's not unpleasant. And this is one of the wide areas where we, with our cultural training, need to practice turning. We need to practice turning towards, with wonder, what isn't unpleasant. We need to allow there to be interest in what isn't unpleasant. Not because it's going to save me from the unpleasantness, but just in its aliveness. Something we hadn't noticed before, something that feels good, that we could actually open to that without making it into more than it is. We could open with that uplifting energy that we could experience as curiosity. There could be questions in the mind, there could be no activity in the mind, and just the kind of childlike wonder. A kind of almost like osmosis into oneness with an experience. In the same text, there's another one of my favorite lines. This text is called the Yog Vashisht. And what it is this very, very, very long book of questions and answers between a teacher and a student from maybe about 1,000 years ago. In India. And the student, who happens to be a god, keeps not getting it. And so the teacher says, okay, I see that you didn't understand, so we'll go back again to the beginning. So at one point, the student, Ram, asks the teacher, Vashisht, I've heard that people say the world is not real. And I don't get this. Why did they say that? I don't understand that teaching. And the teacher Vashisht says, it's not true that the world is not real. It's not true that the world doesn't exist. It's not true that the world is a figment of our imagination. The world is real. The way we take it in is what is made up. The way that we take it in is completely our imagination. It's completely our fantasy. It's completely unreal. I want to suggest a couple of ways that that unreality happens in a real world. So that we can kind of notice and then sort of unpin ourselves from those, from that unreality. So one great thing to play with on retreat in silence is to be able to track down how the mind makes assumptions and then goes along on that assumption as if it's true. So the way we've received each other, impressions from each other. There are people that we feel open towards and people we feel afraid of and people that we feel better and worse than. We feel intimidated, etc. And if we just try to go back and feel how that started. I'm open towards that person because they're wearing a white shirt and just like so-and-so did or whatever, or I like white. Or I feel intimidated by that person because they have a beard or they have long hair or they have whatever. One of the fun things and sometimes weird or surreal things about traveling and so being kind of at the mercy of my hosts where I go and being able to land in the lap of different kinds of hospitality in different countries is that I'm often walking around in a culture that I don't know very well in things that I've borrowed from people I'm landing with. And then sometimes getting a sense of how that comes across in a particular culture. So in the United States, I might be in a borrowed car, since I don't own a car in the United States. And in the United States car culture, then if I'm in my stepmother's station wagon with the church sticker on the back, then that's who people think I am and relate to me that way. Oh, I go to the same church, or you know, I hate the church because whatever happened to me when I was little. So letting it be fun rather than a kind of checklist of all the things your mind is doing wrong, but letting it be fun to catch what are the signals that your mind has taken in a certain way, and what is the way that you walk on that fictitious ground as if it's real ground. You go far forward and sometimes quite far on a completely wrong assumption about someone because of their shoes or their sleeping bag or whatever, which might not be theirs. Or they might not have chosen it. It might have been a gift. Or they didn't have so much time to go shopping or whatever. So there are assumptions that are completely, completely fictitious, completely made up, that we take as real. So that's one really easy way to start to play with this teaching about what's real and what's unreal. There are also our expectations. And I read another great little piece by Lunig about expectations, something like, maybe I can write it down, let's see. Something like when we expect sun, may it rain, and when we expect congratulations, may we receive a stray dog, and this kind of thing. Just coming back to the fun-loving part of us that even if we kind of like sunny weather better than rainy weather, the part of us that thinks we need sunny weather to be okay and to function, we kind of want to foil. There's something in us that's mischievous and wants to foil that demand, that demanding part of us that wants to require what we prefer. So noticing in our experience where we are expecting, as I mentioned this morning, and how far we can go along in that, and how lovely it is when our expectations are foiled. Whether we expected something bad and something good that we liked came, or the other way around. One time I was in my first sort of year of intensive meditation practice and was having a very intense time. There were memories from childhood sexual abuse coming up, and I was in a very supportive environment, working in a meditation center with a staff of 13, half of whom were also survivors of sexual abuse. And we had group therapy, like weekly, that was part of the staff sort of support that we received. And I could do retreat days and meditate a lot and meet teachers. But I'd saved up some retreat days, which we could save up, to do a women's retreat that was coming just before I went home to work with my family with a therapist and for the first time after allowing this part of me to come back alive. And I was expecting it to be a firestorm after all the intensity of the whole summer. To be on a women's retreat with two female teachers and feel really safe to go into all of this pain and chaos. And I remember it as five of the most peaceful days of my life, where nothing happened except kind of calm, a lovely calm for about 5 days. And at the very end of my days of the retreat, one of the teachers was asked to talk about her life experience and her meditation experience, her spiritual path. And so she did. She just described her path, which was just as good as anybody else's. But there was something in it that was intimidating to me, and because, of course, she was also 30 years older than I was, and something got triggered in there, and I felt despair, like I could never be that good, kind of thing. So the sort of 5 days of calm and then this seemingly ridiculous little trigger of hearing another person's story and that triggering a sense of helplessness, hopelessness. And I had the chance to have an interview with her, and I mentioned that I was feeling at sea again. And it was the first time a teacher in that tradition of insight meditation didn't just say, be aware of the feelings, notice it in your body, and it will change, which is also true. That's a valid response. But it was the first time someone maybe saw a little bit more deeply into a pattern and said, this is going to take a long time. You need to put a lot of time into getting to know this pattern. It's not that I told her that I don't think I was even aware that I was comparing myself to her and putting myself down. But she surely easily picked that up in what I reported. And she just said very simply, this will take time. And don't give up. It's possible. So leaving room for when we expect a firestorm, there could be an enveloping calm for days on end. And then just when you're kind of settling into the calm as your new home, there could be a tiny trigger that's just the right size for you. So with the gatekeeper of deep acceptance or contentment and the gatekeeper of wonder, not only as a mental activity, but more as a kind of opening and confidence that we can meet our experience as it is and can feel how well those two gatekeepers coexist. When there's deep acceptance, it's actually possible to meet our experience, to be in full contact with what is instead of gauging it by what we think should be. And part of our practice today is coming out of the thinking more and more often coming into the body sensations, the sounds, something that's more direct than the thought. And as we come into the tactile realm, as we come into our tactile experience, we can start to be aware of funny things that happen to our mind that we assume and we go on our assumption as real instead of staying with the actual experience. So there are some really interesting and clever sort of experiments that people are doing now. Basically psychology experiments that can help us feel into this practice of getting tactile, or as one of my friends talks about, ascending into the body, ascending down into the body. So this is kind of a leading edge of human awareness of ourselves that's happening through science in this case. One of the experiments was having people play with a puzzle and put together a puzzle, just a regular puzzle, but the pieces of the puzzle were not smooth, they were rough. And so people were not aware that the puzzle had anything to do with the experiment. They were just putting the puzzle together, waiting for them to hear a story about two people. And then they were asked to report back what they'd heard in the story. So simple, clever experiment. The people who, so there must have been two puzzles. There's always the control group where it's not a rough puzzle, but a smooth puzzle. So the people who had the rough puzzle reported that the interaction between the two people that they just heard about after touching the rough pieces of puzzle was harsh and chaotic and disharmonious. And the people who had the smooth puzzle had the opposite kind of report, that it was a smooth and harmonious interaction. People were given heavy clipboards and asked to evaluate different people's resumes. And when then they had the less heavy clipboards and evaluate other people's resumes, or some people had heavy, some people had light, same people, whatever it was. And the people who had the heavy clipboards in a kind of work style environment, although it was a psychology experiment, the people who had the heavy clipboards tended to rate the person's resume as being more serious, more likely to take the work seriously, and also they evaluated their own assessment and their own accuracy as being more important and more serious, having more weight. So there are maybe a half dozen examples like this. Basically, what I want this to do for us is to inspire us to notice how things that we're completely unaware of, like the texture of what you're lying on, may affect your meditation, your sense of how important meditation is for you, or how you're resting, not just in the very direct way of you need it to be softer so you can be more comfortable, but the texture maybe of the outer surface of what you're lying on, the texture of the carpet, the texture of the plates, the texture of the grass, the texture of the air. To be that open to that much sensitivity in ourselves, that we could start to disentangle what are the false assumptions in the way that we're taking in our experience, and how we then walk on that as if it's solid ground until we kind of crash to the actual ground. People in the psychology realm talk about the touch, the sense of touch, as being the most underappreciated sense, as well as the first one to develop for us physically. And I think that has significance for us in our explorations, which are not psychological. But there's a way that coming back to touch, noticing how touch influences our thinking, how touch influences our perceiving also visually and sound, etc. And then coming back just to touch, just to the tactile. And starting to feel the difference between just the tactile, letting it just be hard, just be heavy, just be soft, just be light. Less believing and less entanglement in the associations that go on from there, but coming back just to touching, being touched by the world. Is part of our movement towards what we could call source, or some kind of original mind, or original heart, or original being. And we can also use this psychology to uplift our meditation. So we can also kind of manipulate ourselves when we need to. When we're feeling down and heavy, we can try, just play with holding a feather, holding a piece of grass, holding something light and feeling the lightness and just noticing what happens, what comes across. Feeling the difference between manipulating for a kind of closed-minded agenda and playing with breaking habits through this manipulation. It's also important to notice, as I mentioned at the beginning, that when there's a river of experience coming through us, there are so many tactile sensations happening right now. We're aware of a few of them. So this is another way that our way of receiving the world gets off kilter. What is it that's going on in our experience that is filtering and deciding what we notice in our tactile experience? So we start to become aware of kind of little pools or puddles of emotional charge around certain experiences. And this can be a wonderful way to get to really deep places that just need some ventilation, they just need some tenderness. We don't need to do a lot of analysis or heavy thinking for deep healing to happen. So if we notice that our attention keeps going to a certain color or a certain sensation in the body or a certain kind of sound, a certain sort of object, a certain kind of texture, we might notice that we keep looking at what's smooth, or we might keep looking at what's rough, or we might keep looking at what's hard, or we might keep looking at what's soft. We could just allow that to click. Ah, I keep noticing what's smooth, or I keep noticing what's hard, keep noticing what's rough. And feel if that is a habit energy with an emotional charge that is calling for attention. And instead of letting it be this triggered habit that we keep paying attention to something that we either hate or want or whatever. So not just what happens to come into your noticing, but what your noticing keeps going after. You keep tripping up on it. Keeps triggering. More often than not, all we need to do is to kind of let actual contact happen there and be still there for a while and just feel it as it is. There's emotional charge and there's a simple texture, for example, going on, and letting it be. Often, we might feel a ripple in the chest when we're getting quiet. We might feel a contraction in the throat when we're starting to relax or whatever. And more often than not, there's an assumption that that shouldn't be happening because I'm supposed to be relaxing or I'm supposed to be whatevering. And we take it as wrong. And we try to turn away from that. And so sometimes just to allow that to call attention as much as possible, letting it not be with tension, but just gently bringing tenderness to that that's calling for attention. And knowing it to be with emotional charge, just knowing it to be. There's contraction in the throat with emotional charge. And so our curiosity and our wonder can be meeting that whole package. There's emotional charge that makes me feel uncomfortable. I want to get out of here. Or I think it's really important and exciting or whatever, something's happening. Just kind of letting tenderness wrap all around that whole thing. And staying still for a little bit. Many times, what we feel to be our problems or someone else's problems or the problems of the world, what's happening is this. There's a pool of emotional charge because of an experience you've had. It's just such a simple situation. And if we can go really simply with tenderness to that and just stay still there for a while. It's, again, it's a natural occurrence. It's not something wrong with you. And then feeling the difference when there starts to be sometimes a little more sense of spaciousness, feeling the difference between a triggered noticing and just something coming into your notice with a kind of maybe elegance or lightness. It comes into your notice, something that you normally don't notice. So a piece of bark on the ground instead of your favorite bird or whatever. And just leaving more room more often for a space where things can come into your notice, and that tends to be a more creative movement, a more freeing movement. Anton read me part of an interview with an artist in Parabola magazine. I don't know the name of the artist. And she talks about sense impressions. And she was some kind of visual artist. And she said that in her experience of herself and others, often when we think we're receiving an impression of someone or something, what's really happening is that somewhere, not consciously, but we are actually trying to make an impression on that person or object. We're not actually receptive. And her experience of receptivity, what she would call really openness to receive an impression, happens when she's maybe drawing an animal or a person or a plant. And she feels something happen. She described it as being between her shoulders and her knees, something like, excuse me, a satellite dish with the belly at the center as the kind of most receptive place. So being open to feel in your own experience what helps you kind of go parabolic. Go, it's funny that in Parabola magazine she's giving an image of a parabolic dish. But I find it to be quite an accurate, sensitive image, actually. Just out of the head, in the body, a kind of concavity centered on the belly, where there's communication possible in a way that's without words. And that communication without words, we could call the fourth gatekeeper of liberation. We haven't talked about the third yet. Might get to that tomorrow. Communication that doesn't need words to happen. Communication where there is concavity and not just a going out and trying to get or trying to impose. So receiving life by letting it come in is a way of starting to get the sense of, very simply, very directly, very immediately, of what Vasishtha might have been speaking about what is real. There is a real world. But it's so not what we think it is or what we could imagine. But we do experience it and we do participate in it. We are it as well. So sometimes it's helpful just letting the sense impressions come in, as we started with today with sounds and body. You can play with that with color, playing with looking and then allowing color in. And sometimes we might start to feel that even being so attentive to the senses and the sense impressions still leaves some kind of switch in us of over-alertness on. So as resting starts to happen and we start to allow resting to come and take over a little bit more, sometimes being with the senses is very full and connecting. Other times, being with the senses is too much impression coming in, too heavy of an impression coming in. And there's a natural turning inward towards more delicate impressions inside, more subtle impressions inside. So kind of inner texture. So I'll give an example. We might start by settling into a place in the body, so a location on the planet Earth, a particular one that we happen to be able to feel. And I'm suggesting that if all else is equal, the lower belly is a great place to have a friendship with. So we might start in a place, and as we start to allow that place to speak to us, we start to allow the actual experience of that to take up more and more space, and the image of that to have less room, and the memory of that and the ideas of that to have less and less say. We may start to feel as if the very same place, we're still in that place, the same place starts to feel more wide and more dispersed and more light, more kind of fluffy. Not so contained, not so held together inside what we thought, where we thought our body is. So this is a really simple experience that it's not like a metaphysical experience, but it's something that for some reason people don't talk about. It can easily happen to anyone. You don't have to have a lot of experience with meditation, that you actually feel your body and the actual feeling is so different from your image of the body that you don't trust your own experience and you keep kind of leaning on memory and image. And there's a way that sometimes we can give ourselves the suggestion to let go of memory, to let memory be off duty. It doesn't have to hold the body together. And then we start to already feel the body as being a little bit bigger and more dispersed than what we see. So there's still location, but the location is kind of spreading out and doesn't match our map. And if we could, at that point, not try to put it back together and make it fit, image and tactile. Sometimes we can feel a pleasantness in that spreading out and fluffing out. And we could allow that goodness or pleasantness of that spacing out, spreading out, not holding together. We could allow the pleasantness of the spaciousness start to be what we tune into. And so we actually leave location behind. There's a kind of juncture where we would, if we would say, oh no, I'm supposed to be feeling the breath, I'm supposed to be feeling the lower belly, we would be disrupting our subtle, natural deepening. And if we could allow that actual experiencing, which is a subtle sensation, there's still a kind of subtle sensation. It's not like there's no sensation of body. but allowing an experience that we can't quite locate, but we can still feel it. A sense of endlessness, a sense of not necessarily being walled off from the world. Other times, we might notice that there's a kind of boredom in the way we're practicing. The way we're practicing is boring. Going back to the breath, going back to the belly, going back to the sounds. There's something that's kind of getting calloused inside. We're doing the same thing too often. We're not allowing some kind of natural creativity or shift to happen. So it's normal that we'll get bored when we're doing so little and we're used to doing so much. That's one thing. But we can start to feel a subtle callousing when we're not paying attention to a natural subtle shifting in the way we're practicing. And so then we might kind of pause. There might be curiosity and wonder and deep acceptance that this is normal. The possibility of noticing that callousing is already a sign of deep sensitivity that is growing in that very moment. And then trusting that deep sensitivity that can feel something's getting too mechanical here. And trusting that deeper sensitivity to be a leading edge into whatever is our best guess of what's deeper. What would be a deeper perspective? What would be a deeper place to feel from? What would be important to do now? Going deeper often at first means kind of going blind. So we've become accustomed to seeing in a certain way, having a particular perspective and acting from there. And going deeper usually means that we need to go somewhere where we can't see, and we have to feel our way along at first. It's often deeper. It's interesting, this thing about how something that is heavy, literally, and that we call heavy, would influence the mind towards what we call heavy as in terms of serious and committed. And so similarly, going deeper often, at least at first, goes along with a kind of movement lower down. So again, ascending down into the body. And if we could let ourselves trust that we could go blind and trust this deeper feeling, and that we will learn to see in that deeper place if we give ourselves time. These kind of more, could talk about instinctual in a different kind of way, not like biological instinct, but maybe spiritual instinct. So spiritually instinctual movements that can happen, that we trust the feeling rather than the seeing. Going back more to an original being, a deeper place. Can trust that first sense, the tactile sense, to lead the way towards the development of the other senses, that will go deeper into our own being where we really don't know where we are, what we're doing. With time, we'll start to be able to hear, we'll start to be able to see in this inner place. We'll start to be able to taste and smell in more and more subtle and deep ways and places. And curiously, as we go deeper and this deeper clarity comes, the movements that can happen, these spiritually instinctive movements, start to be more and more light and more like leaps. So again, Emerson has a really nice description. When we reach a certain clearness of perception, so in this case, we're talking about a clearness of tactile perception, subtly feeling our way deeper, I'm talking about inner tactile. We accept a knowledge and motive above selfishness. So we're no longer going according to, and we can't go anymore according to what should be or what we thought was going to happen or what we assumed was happening. And it's as if the whole energy of body and mind flowed in one direction. Doesn't that sound kind of New Age? This is Emerson, like long, you know, last more than one century ago, I think. As if the whole energy of body and mind flowed in one direction. So we're not dividing against ourselves, trying to keep track of how we're doing, etc., and walking on false assumptions. And then he says, once we were stepping a little this way and a little that way, now we are as people in a balloon and do not so much think of the point we have left or the point or the point we would make as of the liberty and glory of the way. The liberty and glory of the way. It's kind of old language. So the freedom and the glory. It's a good word. Let's take it. So letting ourselves go blind again, finding a kind of leading edge of a more spiritual evolution, we could call a spiritual development that we haven't let our being go through yet. We've let our body have its, more or less, have its natural development. We've let our mind have a somewhat natural development and then overdosed on it. And we could leave room for going blind again, going where we can't see, we can't hear, but we can feel our way along, gently, with tenderness, knowing that we don't know what's going to happen next. And the love of that, that kind of growth tip, sort of, the aliveness there that's concentrated all in that growth tip. And so instead of being a me who's trying to hold it all together so that I can fit along in the world of all of you, instead of treating my body as if it doesn't know how to hold itself together, but kind of being there to keep shepherding it back, we start to slip more and more into a sense of life holding it all, and we holding it all together. So rather than holding it together, there's a togetherness that we participate in that holds it all, that can hold it all. And so Rumi says, neither I nor we in the language of the heart. So we lose not just that isolation and dryness when we're just trapped in our own unnecessary suffering, the weight that we put on through blame and shame, and not enoughness. And we're not trapped in a kind of dangerous world where we have just a few friends and we are in it together and we can handle it, we can hold it together. But it's so wide that we don't even find the word we in what is holding it all. But there's a definite togetherness, and so it starts to feel more and more often like a friendly world where there are dangers, instead of a dangerous world where we have a few friends. And the dangers kind of call upon that openness where I've called it wonder or childlike mode. The deep acceptance, so we're not surprised that something challenging comes or that there's a danger in the world. But we can stay friendly. And that deep communication where what is most important to stay true to is communicating, is in interchange throughout that kind of togetherness that is holding it all, that can hold it all, that is in us as well. Are there any questions or comments? It's very welcome. Sometimes the talks go very dense, so there's a lot that's been said, so feel free to ask anything.
I'm not quite sure how deeper, deeper, you say.
Yeah.
She goes deeper.
Yeah. One way is to not knowing how and doing it anyway. So my best guess of what is deeper, trusting not the thoughts.
But are you talking about the senses and feelings, or?
We can play with it that way, and it's a good way to begin, so that this kind of hint about often it does happen that going deeper is about actually going down. So feeling your feet, for example, could be a way to access depth. Even if it seems to be so simple that why is this deeper than my deep thoughts or whatever. Yes?
I've got something to say, but I don't know how to do it.
Yeah, take your time.
Then I did some Vipassana just for a very short while, and well, that's the sort of scanning the sensations are going down,
yeah.
As you said, mm-hmm. It might be the way. But just here and as we came then,
yeah,
you know, I was doing, you know, trying to do the retreat and the things you were suggesting, instead of going down like that, I was going somehow. I was feeling whole my body like in one move.
Yeah.
I can
yes.
It,
yes. Good.
And when I go Vipassana and I go through senses and sensations and come down, somehow I feel like I'm just going on the surface.
Yeah.
I'm not really going. I mean, I just could compare it actually these days.
Yeah.
With the practice, your practice.
Yeah.
I feel like I'll go a little bit, I don't know, maybe it's my imagination, deeper.
Yeah.
And actually, that probably in my heart,
yeah,
it's more obvious and more,
yeah,
you know. It is a new personality, but here it's like I really go out of breath.
Yeah.
But is it what you mean by deeper, going inside?
So what you described of feeling the whole body,
mm-hmm,
would be one shift we could call towards depth, as opposed to that kind of me scanning my body. So me being the whole body with, like Emerson's thing of the whole body and energy
inside,
at
inside
one.
Down.
Well, let's have two different depths, let's say. One is where there's less me with my willpower moving my mind and my attention through my body. And it's very discrete entities, like there's me and there's my body and there's me and that sensation and that sensation and that sensation. That can be very helpful for some people and very calming, etc. But there, and that can start to shift into where the scanning through the body starts to happen more and more by itself. But what you're describing, the contrast between me feeling my body and moving my attention from the top of the body down, as opposed to the sense of the whole body all at once, and the way your face shifted as you said that, etc., tells me that whole body thing, which is coming with a little bit less easy mental effort. It's taking something else than mental effort for that to happen. And that's partly why it's deeper. And then the experience itself is more immersion in rather than me doing something well. So that's one thing. And then a second thing would be, I wasn't so much talking about scanning the body, although that's fine, was just if I have a question, if I get the sense that of superficiality, I get the sense in my experience that there's superficiality, there's a not going deep, there's a staying on the surface, and that I was calling callousing. What is happening is that there's a whisper of that there's another way. And so it's leaving room for that whisper or that slight movement to come into place. And one way to leave room would be to fix my attention on something else, lower down in the body. So partly it's to get myself out of the way so that the shift can happen. Because I've got all these agendas about what I think should happen and shouldn't, etc. But I don't know how to let that kind of blind, deepening shift happen. So I get myself out of the way, and I might as well go to a lower part of the body because maybe that will help suggest deeper to my atmosphere and my consciousness. Yeah, belly or feet, for example, just like really simplistic metaphor. Mm-hmm. Go down. Or go in.
Down.
Why not? Go in to the core of you. It's another great way to kind of accidentally start to be aware of this natural blind shift into depth. Blind in this good sense that I'm talking about today, that it's necessarily blind because we haven't had the chance to develop that clear perceiving that will come with time, with practice. But we can, as the cells did, feel their way along. Before they had eyes, they felt their way along. Our cells in this body had no eyes at first, but they found their way where they needed to go. And they did amazing things. They still do. And also this, it feels a little bit like coming into the back of the body can help. Like when there's that, I've gotta find out how to get depth. And notice if your energy's in the front of your body, then come to the back. If your energy goes to the back of the body, like, oh, I can't handle this, got to get away, then maybe come into the front. We can notice what our stress response is. Are we in the front? Are we in the top? Are we in the back? And go to the other end. That's another way. Good, thank you. Thank you for listening. There's time for walking before supper. And of course, as always, you're welcome to stay resting in the hall now or anytime.